Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of The Julia LaRoche Show. I am pleased to bring to you this conversation with Double Line Capital's Deputy Chief Investment Officer, Jeff Sherman. He is also the host of The Sherman Show podcast. In this episode, we get Jeff's reaction to the FOMC meeting where Jay Powell left rates unchanged. We also got Jeff's outlook on the economy, why he thinks inflation will likely go sideways, and why he thinks that we won't see a rate cut until at least June. He also shared that investors who have been betting on the rate cuts, they might be taking a bit of a risk there. I really enjoyed this conversation with Jeff. I learned so much from him, and I know you will too. Jeff Sherman, Deputy CIO of Double Line Capital and host of the Sherman Show podcast. It is great to see you again and great to welcome you on the Julia LaRoche Show for the first time, Jeff. Thanks for taking the time.
Yes, I never thought I was going to be invited. So thanks for reaching out.
Well, I'm so glad and of all days to have you. Of course, the FOMC, and we just had Powell's presser. And I think we should start there. Let's start with the news of the day, the FOMC leaving rates unchanged, Jay Powell's presser. I want to get more of your big picture take of today's news.
Yeah, I think, the summary is pretty straightforward here is that Jay said, hold on, we're not cutting in March. Right. I thought kind of the baseline coming in was that they would move the risk to balanced, which he did mention. He did kind of fight this notion that, the inflation is on track to be where that makes them comfortable. And I think he said that although they've seen it because people had glommed onto Waller's comments, earlier before they went to the quiet period of, well, the 3-month annualized and the 6-month annualized core PCE is at 2%. And so a lot of people were thinking that, okay, the Fed's not waiting for the year-over-year number to be there. They're going to take this trend and identify it underway. And that kind of sets the path for the March cut. March is where we start to cut in the cycle. It was interesting. He did say that they have reached the peak in the cycle. So he did admit that at this point. I think after, it's been roughly, 6-7 months since the last hike. So I think it's pretty fair to say at this point. I think he was very confident in the idea that inflation was not going to reaccelerate to where they would have to continue to hike. And I think that's what gave him some confidence there. But he kind of poured some cold water on what's been the risk rally, right? And the risk rally has been predicated on the rate cuts. They're going to begin. Every single question it felt like was that, well, are you above neutral? Where are we at in interest rates? Real yields are high. And I want to tell people, enjoy that. As an investor, you're getting positive real yields. And so this idea that, the Fed was going to deliver the cut so early, I think it's because Powell seemed dovish in the previous two pressers, right, back in November and back in December. And so I think he did put a little bit of cold water on it. But really, coming into this, we didn't think March was really that much in play. There's optionality there. I think Jay Powell said that today. He likes having optionality. But to me, it feels like it's a few months away from probably that first rate cut. And so, I was talking to my boss, before he went on television early today, and we're just kind of talking. He's like, well, you think May's in play or June? I'm like, it just feels like it should be more like June, right? We get new SEPs there. Maybe we get a cut there. But my kind of baseline at this point is that I think the Fed cuts, the outcome, and I'm using nerdy math word because, you know me, Julia.
Do it. I love it.
I think it's a bimodal outcome. And I think we're either going to get 2 or 3 cuts, like, maybe you get them quarterly, maybe get like a June, September, December, just to kind of ease the path. Or we get something like 250 basis points worth of cuts. I'm not going to call that 10 cuts because they're not going to be 10, right? By definition, they're just going to be severe. And the difference in the outcome is that, are we on this glide path? Jay was very careful to not declare victory yet. He said he's not declaring victory. The soft landing question was asked today. He said, no, it's way too early to say that. And so I give him a lot of kudos for all of that. And I think the kind of softest landing is that they see that they can kind of tweak the policy at the margin. They don't ignite a new bout of inflation. I think that you could see that pass. I think that has a slightly higher probability than the other, or a higher probability than the other. But the other is that if the higher for longer mantra and keeping rates where they are start to physically inflict plane into the economy. And the economy has done very well. It's surprised, and even Jay Powell said it's, you know, it surprised most economic forecasters. But if you go back and study some of the history, you'll see that typically when you have a disinflationary cycle and you're coming off a somewhat elevated inflation rate, it tends to be positive for growth, right? Because we've been mired in this world where prices are accelerating, doesn't feel like you're making much progress. But ultimately, if you're kind of paying similar prices, they go up a little bit, there still is this kind of consumption component. And so I thought Jay did a very good job today. You know, it's not often we give the Fed the kudos they deserve. And, you know, his communication policy was very strong. What I'm still kind of, you know, perplexed about is where are they going with QT? And there's been a lot of strategists on the street talking about the quantitative tightening QT program. And, you know, if the Fed was going to reduce that, they're going to, you know, kind of taper their kind of roll off. It's the opposite of tapering of purchases, right? And, you know, there's been some strategists writing about this and thinking that would set the tone for the rate cuts. And I'm not sure about the sequencing because I feel like the Fed wants the balance sheet lower. He took credit for how much they've rolled off, you know, $1.3 trillion already off their balance sheet. That's a lot of money, Julia. $1.3 trillion, we can agree, right?
That's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot. And so I think from that standpoint, you know, the question is the market's absorbed it. They want to change the dynamics of the balance sheet. They want to use it to be able to reload it at some other point in the future. And so I think that, you know, again, there's a little bit that maybe at the next meeting they're going to discuss more about the path of it. But, you know, he came out early on and addressed it. They're staying at the same levels. Rates aren't moving. It's probably premature to call cuts. He essentially then said March is off the table. I don't think the data set's going to change meaningfully over the next 6 weeks. So I think March should kind of reduce and be out of play. So what does this mean short term? Probably, you know, you may get rates a little bit higher, although rates rallied at the back of the day. Equities kind of felt some pain towards the end of that, went out of the lows today. But again, these tend to be volatile trading days. So let's see where things shake out over the next couple of trading sessions. But, you know, for a meeting that was supposed to be a whole lot of nothing, I didn't glean a lot, except I just like the way Jay carried himself today. I thought he did a relatively good job. And he's telling the market that you're a little bit optimistic. And being a little bit optimistic to me connotes the idea risk has ran a little far and maybe potentially rates should back up a little bit from here. And again, when I talk about a little bit, maybe it's like 20, 25 basis points or something. But, you know, we're sitting here today as we talk with a 10-year south of 4% now.
Yeah. Yeah, the 10-year dip below 4. Right. That was a great frame up for the conversation. And I am curious, because I didn't even think I was going to ask you this. If you were in that room, that press room with Powell at the podium, what would you ask? Like, what would you be curious about?
I would have really dug into the whole idea about the quantitative tightening. I thought the opening question was very good. The opening question, I think it came from Jenna, I think she's at the New York Times, right? And she just asked about the consumption and the growth and, you know, what does this mean? You know, you're talking about potentially cutting rates, but you have to juxtapose that against this stronger economy. And, you know, I thought it was interesting ultimately how Jay answered it. And I haven't answered your question. I'll get to it. But the way he answered it was that we have a dual mandate and growth's not a part of it. Which to me, it's like, wow, it's kind of interesting. You should think about what you're doing to the economy. But I just kind of thought that was an interesting comment I heard throughout it. But I would have definitely asked about quantitative tightening. What's the plan with the balance sheet? You know, what are you looking to do? Especially now that, you know, we've looked at the quarterly refunding announcements, right? For the last two consecutive announcements, that this is what Treasury does to, you know, pay down bonds that have net new issuance because we have the deficits. And they've been smaller than the expectations of the market for the last two quarters. And so to me, it seems like reducing QT while doing that, you know, that actually sets a rate rally because if you think of supply and demand, right, there's less supply of bonds out there. And so I think it's interesting. To me, it'd be interesting to see how he's thinking about that. Obviously, he doesn't work for Treasury. They set monetary policy. He's not worried about the other side. He does work with Yellen on that side. But I do think it would be very interesting to know what the plan is for QT. And I would also ask, is QT, the reduction of QT, a necessary step prior to cutting rates as well. And we've thought about that, you know, over, you know, since we invented QE, or, you know, resurrected, I guess they say, back in the 08-09 era, is the sequencing, right? You're doing these things to be accommodative once you get the zero bound, and then you hike rates, and you're also, you know, rolling off the balance sheet. Those are double doses of tightening. And so the question becomes, can you do one without the other, right? And I think that's the interesting thing. It's the path of least resistance to take down the QT first before you do the interest rates, or is he really more worried about the interest rate sensitive sectors? Let's bring some of those rates out. He referenced interest rate sensitive sectors multiple times today, right? That there is some pain in the economy, or they're being affected by these more interest rate sensitive areas. And so the question becomes, should he bring that down a little bit, bring policy rates down, right? Help out some of these other areas, but continue to roll off the balance sheet. So to me, that's where I would have focused. There was enough questions on, when are you going to cut? When are you going to cut? When are you going to cut? I mean, it was like everybody had the same question, but continued to ask it. So that's probably where I'd have went with it today. But I think he's doing a pretty good job with his communication policy right now.
Hey there. I hope that you are enjoying listening to this episode. If you can, please take a moment to subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcast. And if you could leave us a rating and a review, it would help us so much in continuing to grow the show and bringing some incredible guests for these longer form discussions. Thank you so much for your support, and I hope you enjoy the rest of this episode. You mentioned too earlier that today the meeting kind of poured water on the risk rally, and you brought up a really interesting point too for investors to enjoy getting that positive real yield. Can we just double click a little bit more on that? Because that seems like something that's important to also emphasize.
Yeah. So when I talk about a real yield, what I'm talking about is the nominal yield, or the yield you see on the screen, less inflation. And Powell even talked about this today, where their policy rate is, and I'll just call it 5 3/8. I'll take the midpoint of the range that they target. And he says you need to subtract off some forward-looking measure of inflation. And he said that probably puts you above what a lot of people forecast the neutral rate to be. Now, that's wonky. It's what we call R star, the neutral rate. What that's supposed to be is a policy which is neither restrictive nor accommodative in the marketplace. And we all know as practitioners that it's not observable. No one knows it is. It's a formula in an econometric model, and that's what it is. And so I think what the questioning was trying to do was say, okay, the policy rate is tight relative to this R star concept, and that's the real neutral rate of interest rates. And so where I'm going with this is, Julia, what's your forecast on inflation? And you could tell me it's 2%, you could tell me it's 3%, maybe it's 4%. Well, if let's say it was 3% and the 10-year treasury, let's just call it 4%, you subtract those two, well, that means you're getting 1% real yield. It's a positive number. It's a positive real yield. So that means after inflation, you are making progress, right? So you put that against something where, you know, we were in a 2% inflation world, the 10-year treasury yielded 1%. Well, that's a negative real yield, right? So you lose purchasing power over time relative to inflation. So why I'm emphasizing this positive real yield is that it's important as an investor, what you always want to think about is, can you beat inflation? The hurdle is not zero. The hurdle is always the inflation rate, because you need to protect your purchasing power. So as you talk to, you know, especially when you talk about retirement, and it's that it's not just, you know, protecting the nest egg, it's making sure that you can keep pace, your cash flow keeps pace with inflation. So when I talk about a positive real yield in the marketplace, and every part, I believe every part of the US Treasury curve offers you a positive real yield, well, that means you can invest in that. It's a government guaranteed asset, so you should get all your money back at maturity. And when that happens, if the inflation rate is lower than that nominal yield, you have outstripped inflation, you've made progress. And so when you think about it and you look at the bond market today, and you can look like investment grade corporate bonds, you can look at high yield bonds and junk bonds and loans, and you can put a bunch of this stuff together, and you can build a portfolio that doesn't have a lot of risk in it at all today, doesn't have meaningful credit risk. And, you know, it yields like 5.5%, 5.75%. And I think we can all pretty much agree that's going to be above the inflation rate over the next year or two. And if that's the case, and again, maybe there's an exogenous shock once again, but if that's the case, investors are making progress against that inflation. And so to me, that's what's important as an investor. It's that one wants to outperform that inflation side.
Mm-hmm. And also when you're getting that kind of yield, couldn't that have implications on stocks if it's like, hey, that's actually really attractive to me as an investor to put, you know, to allocate more toward fixed income? Would that have an impact?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, it's not just the choices that I have to buy bonds or I have to put it in cash. There's stocks, there's alternatives, there's speculative assets. We now know that there's these ETFs on cryptocurrency, right? There's all kinds of ways to try to invest. And so the basic model is just looking at stocks versus bonds. And it's given the name, it's called the Fed model. I actually don't know why it's called the Fed model. I should know that. But what it does is it kind of looks at the yield on bonds and it compares it to the inverse of the price earnings ratio on stocks. So if you look at the price earnings, it's price divided by earnings. Well, if you invert that relationship and do earnings over price, that's called the earnings yield. So if you think about the stock market, and you know, a lot of people would tell you the forward-looking PE is around 20 today, right? 20. So if I invert 20, right, that actually turns into a 5% earnings yield. So that means essentially what you're getting what you're paying for is you get about a 5% earnings growth on that. And so people have compared kind of bonds to the earnings yield on the stock market to say which one's rich and cheap. But the other thing, Julia, to think about is that not only should you think about the yield, but also think about it in the context of volatility. And we can argue about how volatile stocks are, how volatile bonds are, but I think most of us agree that stocks are more volatile than bonds. So you give me 5 with less volatility versus 5 with more volatility, I'm typically going to choose 5 with less volatility. That's my preference. And so when you think about it too, if you want to get into comparing risk to risk, so if I think about the volatility, let's just say the U.S. stock market, I would say, well, that's pretty much like, it's kind of a junky credit portfolio, right? I'm taking risks. I'm going to have some losers in the portfolio, right? So it's going to be a lower quality portfolio. Well, even after this big risk rally we saw, I mean, one of the best 2 month performances for the Barclays Ag, for high yield bonds, for emerging market, I mean, name it, they were very good consecutive months when it comes to the bond market. Even after that run, you could put together, I'll call it a speculative portfolio, not buying the lowest quality, but things that are, you know, heavily in the single B category, maybe some carefully calculated double B, maybe sprinkling a little bit of triple B risk from commercial real estate, right? Because I don't believe it'll stay triple B through a cycle. I think it's more like single B risk. You can do some of this and you can put together a portfolio without leverage that yields like 11% today. So 11%, if I invert that number, that's a price to earnings ratio equivalent of 9 times earnings, right? I think it's 99, right? So if I look at something like the stock market at its valuation today, I would rather own some of this more speculative credit that yields 10, 11% than adding incremental dollars to that kind of market cap weighted mega cap effect today. And so you're right in the framework of thinking about, you know, kind of how to allocate. And so this is where, you know, a lot of people say, well, you bond guys, you're only going to make 5%, whatever. I mean, we have risky portfolios. We just don't talk about them all the time. And these riskier portfolios, they throw off cash in the double digits today. And so, you know, incremental dollars, you know, we've said this for a few months now that, you know, when the 10-year got to 5%, I mean, you had like AAA, you know, non-government guaranteed mortgages that were yielding 8. I mean, these were no-brainers at that point in time. And so at that point, we're saying the stock market looks extremely rich relative to some of these credits. Now, they're both, you know, stock market still looks rich. I wouldn't say extremely rich to it. So again, do I, Jeff Sherman, own stocks? Yes, I do, Julia. I don't just only own bonds. I have an allocation, but marginal dollars right now, I don't like that mega cap. I like different kind of exposures of trying to express some of those riskier views.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember like our previous conversations. You have an equity portfolio that you manage. I think you still manage it, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
So you're not just purely bonds.
People just say, "Oh, you bond guys." You know, it's just because we tell a lot of stories. Now, stock people don't tell as many stories. I always find it weird that over the last decade or so that they want to talk to the bond side a little bit more than the equity side. Yeah, there's always the story, you know. But I think we have more like robust narratives potentially.
But doesn't the bond market kind of sniff out what's going on before the equity markets?
don't know. I had a podcast recently with Jim Bianco, and we kind of went through this, and I said, you know, like, the bond market gets this credit that it's smarter or it's quicker to do stuff. I just think it's more risk averse. I think when you think about it, is that we're not always just return of return on capital is the saying. It's your return of capital as well. So we tend to think a little more skittishly. I think we tend to look more kind of what we call the tail risk, the bad things happening. But remember, bad things don't happen typically every day in markets, right? They happen, you know, every few years or something. Yeah, you're going to have some idiosyncratic events. But I think what it is that, you know, the bond market, like, we think in terms of inflation, we think in terms of all these things. We're not just utter optimist, I guess, is what it comes down to. And so I think there's a little bit more negativity that's inherent in bond investors' mind. Even if you go to a high yield person, right, that buys credit, that needs to be a bit more optimistic. I think if you compare them to an equity person, most people would say they're pretty pessimistic.
Hmm. Yeah. One of the things I want to bring up with you, you're mentioning just a conversation you had earlier with your boss, which is Jeffrey Gundlach, for the folks watching and listening. And that was about, you know, rate cuts maybe happening in June. But I also watched Jeffrey on CNBC with Scott Wapner, and I wrote down this thing he said about the economy. Like, right now it's kind of Goldilocks, and Goldilocks makes him nervous. I don't know if you share the same view, but can you share, like, the economic view, just kind of where we are now,
yeah,
and then broaden that out to more of your outlook for the year?
Yeah, Goldilocks, and what he was referring to there is, you know, there is this reference of Goldilocks is kind of everything's optimal. And when things are optimal, they don't get typically more optimal. Optimal, in mathematical terms, the optimum is the most optimal solution. And so what he's saying is that when he hears this optimal or kind of concept, well, there's usually only one direction you can go. And I heard him on CNBC as well. He said, it's like a AAA bond, right? It can't be AAA plus. It can only get downgraded. So you either are status quo or you go down. And so from that standpoint, you know, markets are reflecting again, given this rate cut view that got into the market back in November, the rate rally ensued. I think rate rally is what drove the risk rally. And now that's a little bit in question on some of that rate rally with what Jay Powell was saying today. But, you know, the markets were pricing all of this in already. And so, again, the market being forward looking. And so economically, you know, when you come out of these disinflationary environments, and we just talked about this, right, you tend to have decent growth. And now the question becomes, was the fourth quarter, is this the decent growth we got because we had the optimal disinflationary environment, right? Or is this that we're immune to this interest rate policy at this point and we can chug along? And so, you know, his call is still for a recession this year. I think that the probability of recession this year is likely. Likely is not a number. I'm not going to put a number on it. But I don't think it happens at the front half of this year. I think that, you know, we still have enough, like, juice in the tank here. The labor data still seems to be relatively decent. The struggle we have right now is that there's this meaningful headlines of all these job losses, but they're not showing up in the unemployment claims. And so, again, I'm not questioning the data set. It's just, you know, look, there's, like, yesterday was 12,000 job losses at UPS, right? Mm-hmm. Management jobs. So those are not low end jobs. They're kind of,
those are the white collar layoffs that Jeffrey's talked about.
Yeah. So that doesn't look good. But again, that's one company, right? Again, it's a meaningful company in our overall economy. And people look at that as kind of barometer for economic activity. But we're not seeing things really tick up in unemployment claims. We see that the JOLTS data came out this week. There's 9 million jobs, according to that data set, that are available. You know, the unemployed workforce is like 6 million. So look, you've got enough jobs for everybody, right? Now, skills, you know, maybe location, they don't all match up. Bring this all back together, you know, higher interest rates, higher for longer is problematic. And what's happened thus far is that, you know, and this is why I give Jay kudos to what he said today, that it's too early to declare victory, is that economic policy works with a lag. But we can't use some of the other time periods when thinking about this lag, because the structure of the debt coming into this cycle, we had meaningful amounts of fixed rate debt. Remember what happened during the pandemic, corporate America, massive issuance of debt, 2020, 2021, before we got the rate hikes, right? So the coupons are very low on this debt. It was termed out, meaning that it has a longer maturity, 7, 10, 15, 30 years. So this debt load isn't impacted by higher rates yet. It has to be come to maturity before that happens. Simultaneously, consumers, again, if you think about the asset owners, those who own homes, for instance, I don't know one person that really did refi, right, during this period. They during the period of 2020 and 2021, because every mortgage broker was calling everybody. It's everywhere. It's word of mouth. You look at the average coupon or the weighted average coupon of what's outstanding in the mortgage market today, and this is just the agency market, it's like 3 3/8, or it's inside of 3.5%. Okay. So are they affected by higher interest rates? No. Right. From that payment perspective. So who's affected? The backbone of the economy is affected. Small business, right? Where do you get a loan? You get it from a bank. Banks charge you prime rates. They're tied to Fed funds, right? It's typically 300 over Fed funds. So you're talking about, you know, a rate that starts at 8.5 plus a spread, you know, it's this double digit borrowing rates. That is problematic. That's what we call an interest rate sensitive part of the economy, right? But it isn't this pervasive thing because of how much debt was done over long tenors or long maturity dates. And so that is something where it's probably taking longer in this cycle for the interest rates to affect the more broad-based economy. And so this is the challenge is when does it hit? Well, it hits when the debt has to roll over. And you saw the high yield market. There was some data coming in that in late 2024, that there was going to be some problems in the maturity wall of the issuance out there because the high yield market is shorter than the investment grade market. And a lot of that got refied over the course of last summer, right? We got the rate rally with the banking scare. After the scare was over, rates stayed low, spreads came in. And the high yield issuers are like, well, let's just bite the bullet, issue at these levels, and at least we can survive a few more years, right? And so why I say that is that the maturity wall that starts in high yield doesn't start till now early 2025. So maybe that's where we start to run into really hiccups in the economy. And so, you know, again, I'm not dismissive because we got this great GDP report in the fourth quarter. It kind of makes some sense. The consumption's there, but there's also the things that, you know, cause the signs to be nervous about the economy. And so things like, let's look at delinquency rates. So delinquency rates in auto loans, in student loans, in credit cards, they're all accelerating, okay? And they're at levels that are above the pre-pandemic area. It's not like they're accelerating like, you know, a stock price or, you know, something like that, but they're moving up in a meaningful manner. But where they're really moving meaningfully is for the lower income cohorts, the lower FICO strata, and those that, you know, typically tend to be more economically sensitive to things. And so the question does that bleed up into the higher, you know, earners? Does that bleed into the white collar jobs and the like? And so it's a little early to see that, but we stay on alert because that's our job, is to stay on alert. But right now, given that I'm relatively sanguine on the economy, at least for the first quarter, it's hard to have visibility more than 6 months these days just because of how fast things have been going. But, you know, there is the potential for that degradation. And so spreads got tight. We've actually raised a little bit of cash over the last few weeks. Just, again, some of the asset prices got a little high. And we said, you know what? We're not going to participate in this refinancing deal. We'll take cash back instead. We don't want to lend to you at a lower rate. We're going to sit on cash because why? If we're offering 3-year paper, or we're trying to buy 5-year paper, the curve's inverted. We give up 100 basis points to go out there already, right? So that spread, I'd rather just sit in cash for a little bit. And if we get a little push up in rates and it does put a little pressure on spreads, we'll deploy that at a different level. And so our value threshold has just gotten significantly higher lately. So back to your economy question, you know, I don't think we see anything in the first half of this year. But as the higher for longer, this interest rate just kind of continue, the aggregate inflation continues to erode at people, right? So the Fed's lauding this idea that, oh, inflation is potentially sub 3. We're going to get to this level. It's going to have a 2-handle on it. But it's like, but what about the cumulative 15% we've experienced for the last 3 years, right? That has an impact, right? And so you see it in prices everywhere. So again, I'm probably not as negative as some other folks that come up with the bearish and say there's potentially a recession. But I think right now, I think the economy is okay right now. I think it'll continue to be okay, at least in the second quarter. And then I just get a little bit more concerned with some of this buildup of this underlying data we're looking at.
Mm-hmm. Quick follow-on. When you say your value threshold got a little higher, can you just explain that real quick?
What I mean is that, you know, just because a bond is refined and, you know, it's coming in with a lower yield, do we really want to buy at that level? Do we want to lend to this company? Do we want to lend to this kind of structure under that rate? And so what it means is we're calculating that kind of yield relative to our perception of the risk. And so I think about it, you know, we call that like a forward-looking Sharpe ratio, right? Where it's return per unit of risk. And so what we're trying to say here is like, okay, what do we want to own? And so, like, for example, our team was out there, you know, our loan team and our high yield team, they work very intimately together. And like, look, we have these loans that they yield about 9.5 today. You know, we could buy a bond that locks in the yield for 4 years, or the floating rate nature of loans. If the Fed's going to cut, your yield's going to go down, right? And it's like, it's a similar company. We give up 100 basis points to go lock in the debt for 4 years. Do I want to own 8.5 on a fixed rate, or do I want a 9.5 in float? I don't mind floating right now, because I said you should fade the Fed. I still think that it's probably more closer to June for the rate cut. But also, and that kind of sounds attractive. If we're going to get back in cuts, it could bring spread pressures. Spreads could just stay where they are, or they could come. They may widen a little bit, but the curve is coming down. So it's wonky bond stuff. But what I'm getting to is that if I can own something that, you know, floats right now, and let's say yields 9.5, or I can buy the fixed rate at 8.5, and they're same companies, comparable risk, comparable in the capital structure, I probably want to prefer that 8.5 now, because I think over the next 2 years, you do get a meaningful rate cut, right? That we are too tight in policy. And so that's what I mean. It's like, okay, it looks better now to buy that floating rate asset, right? Or to own that, but we need to start thinking about forward looking. And do you really want to lend to this? And like, what if rates do this? And what if we get a hiccup here? What happens to this? Are spreads compensating for that? And so that's the idea, is that you can boycott things. You don't have to invest every single dollar. And when cash is yielding meaningfully above the 10-year treasury, for instance, it's not a bad place to sit and wait for a little bit. Now, I don't want to sit in cash all year. And I do think the treasury market offers some value, cash use protection if bad things happen. And so I know that's a mouthful, Julia, just to say your value threshold. But remember, we have a team that invests in 11 different parts of the bond markets. And so these are the conversations we're having. What are you able to buy? What are you able to buy? What's the base case of your risk? Okay, then we throw, if someone like me will throw a scenario at them, what happens under this, right? And that's how we do our relative value analysis.
Mm-hmm. I would love to watch y'all's macro meetings. They sound fascinating. Can I sneak in two more questions? Do you have time?
Yeah, I do. I do. For you, I do. Yes.
Oh, thank you so much, Jeff. Yeah. Okay. I want to hear a bit more on inflation. And I take it that you guys probably model inflation. I just want to hear more on that. And do you think it's not, I don't know what the question is exactly, but do you think it's not the inflation print that we get, is it not really reflective of like the actual inflation that's out there?
Well,
it sounds like some of the data might be on a serious lag.
Yeah, the problem is, well, yeah, so there's a lot of things that are lagged within it. And the problem with inflation, if you look at the government's measure of inflation, I think they have like 60 different measures, right? So which one? And, you know, there's the one that's related to Social Security, there's the one that's related to, you know, there's CPI, there's PCE that the Fed uses. So there's all these different measures. And Julia's inflation basket is going to be different than Jeff's inflation basket, right? I mean, you have a different consumption pattern than I do. And so from that standpoint, CPI is probably not reflective of most people's individual tastes and preferences, but in the aggregate, it works, okay? The lag that I think most people are referring to is the lag associated with housing these days. And so we've seen house price appreciation that, you know, cumulatively since the pandemic is up like 30%+. You know, we got Case-Shiller data today. It still continues to grind to new highs. We've seen rents that had really spiked during the pandemic. They're starting to decelerate meaningfully now. But the way that the Fed uses housing as an input, I'm sorry, the BLS, it's not the Fed, it's the Bureau of Labor Statistics that calculates it. The way it's used is that it's something called owner's equivalent rent. And so it takes rent, but also translates your house into rent. And how does it do it? It says, Julia, how much do you think you can rent your house for this month? And then they'll call you some other time. Do you have any idea? Maybe you went to Zillow. Maybe you went to something. Maybe you looked down your neighbors. Most people have no clue, right? So it operates mean foot the lag. There's other inputs into it, but it tends to operate with like about a 6 to 7 quarter lag. And so some of the that's driving the inflation rate still at this level on the service side is the housing market. And so maybe that's not real. If you're trying to rent here in Los Angeles right now, you can probably get it a little bit lower than it was a year ago, right? There is enough rent supply out there. I'm sitting here looking out at the Hollywood sign right now from our office here. And, you know, there is supply out there. And so it's not as in demand and desired as it was before. And so I do think that some of those metrics are in there. But what was Jay Powell talking about today? He was attributing some of the disinflation to goods deflation, that goods prices were down year over year. Now, I don't know about you, Julia. When I go out and I consume goods, they sure don't feel down.
No, they don't.
They don't at all. But this is where the economists come in, and they use something called hedonic adjustments. And hedonic adjustments, for most of us, all it means is that they adjust for what attributes you get for that. So you buy a car for $10,000. Well, sorry, that's not even real. You buy a car for $30,000. And, you know, last year that car was $30,000 as well. But now, you know, it has free, you know, leather seats. It didn't have it before. That's an attribute that you're better off. So that they'll say that car is actually not $30,000 now. It's worth less than $30,000 because it has more attributes, right? So therefore, you actually experience deflation in that asset. So this is where, again, it's how economists think, and it's how they try to get through this. So that's another thing that the good side has kind of helped. Yes, there's risk to it with the Houthis and what's been going on the Red Sea and some of the supply disruptions there, shipping freights, and that impacts the whole global kind of trade concept, not just that region, because the boats are in demand everywhere. And so you find that some of these things can offset each other. And so I find it interesting that Jay Powell spent some time on the good side, because prior to the pandemic, if you go back and you look at the goods component of inflation, for roughly 6 years there, except when the Trump tariffs came in 18, goods on a year-over-year basis contributed deflation. That means they had a negative contribution to CPI. Now, during the tariffs, because we raised the prices of things, it obviously did not have a deflationary effect. So I think Jay's coming back to say, we're going to go back to that world, right? And so it's the services side that we're looking at. But I believe probably in your consumption basket, Julia, I know in mine, there's way more services than there's goods, right? I'm not a consumer of things. I'm a consumer of going out. I fly in airplanes. I go to hotels, right? I travel for work. I'm more of a service-oriented person, right? And so that's the part where you're still seeing the inflation, and that's the stickier part. And so I think all in all, from our side, we think that inflation kind of goes sideways-ish from here. It probably has pressure a little bit down. We don't really see it going up. But I think at this point, sideways is still a win, but sideways probably doesn't get Jay excited and eager to cut. And so that's why I'm kind of in that June or later camp at this point.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, it's kind of funny. You mentioned like the surveys. No one's ever called me for a survey ever for any of these like sentiment things, even a poll. Maybe I just don't answer my phone, but it's just kind of a funny thought.
I mean, I keep my ringer off. I have a work phone and a cell phone and my personal phone. And I think on my personal phone, I've had the ringer on like twice in the last like 5 years. It's mainly because I'm expecting a delivery or something, expecting something. But in general, I do. And I never answer the phone unless I exactly know who it is. And so I actually rarely answer my work phone. So because usually I just don't talk on the phone unless I'm expecting something. So
exactly.
So call me if you want. It's just not really it's not the best way to get a hold of me.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I want to end on here is double line. And I always put this question to you guys is don't cross the double line of risk. So when you look out, what is that double line of risk for you today? Maybe the one that folks aren't talking about as much.
Oh, that's I hadn't thought about what is the double line of risk today. You know, I think to me, there's not like a blatant one right now. I don't really feel like from a financial investment perspective that the election is a risk. We can talk about the impact it has on the social construct and just in general, the sentiment in the country. But these are kind of known variables, right? And at war versus when Trump won the election the first time, lots of uncertainty there. We kind of know what Biden does. We know kind of what Trump, I don't know, Trump still seems a little volatile. I'm a little concerned about this whole dictator day one kind of comment, because he wants to be a dictator for a day, he keeps saying. And I'm concerned that bleeds over to more than one day. But yeah, and I think the markets would freak out a little bit off of that. But I don't think the election's there. I don't think the Fed's politicized in this. I think what's really been a risk right now is that people just believe that what worked recently will continue to do so, the momentum trade. And so I'm not here to say the Mag 7 can't be the Mag 7 going forward. They've just done a lot of lifting for the overall markets. And what I've noticed in this last risk rally too is that the triple C market, which is highly speculative, which is very, very shaky companies at this point, we've had a meaningful rally there. And that to me is this idea that the risk sentiment's gotten a little too rich or too excited about it. And so I don't think if I came here and said, well, you know, we think LA office space is probably a place you don't want to put equity capital into, I don't think that's something no one's talking about, right? So I just don't, there's not a lot of things out there I see right now on that standpoint. But I think one danger in the market is betting on the Fed and the path of the forward curve right now on those rate cuts. Because I just don't, especially after today, I get why people did it for the last, let's call it, you know, 12 weeks or so prior to today, because that's the signal you got from Jay. But he said, hold on there, we're a little excited today. And so I think hopefully this brings a little bit of rationality back into the market. But I think we all know that the markets have gotten a little elevated. And I think, you know, what it is, it's trying to be patient. And patience is very hard when you run money because you own assets. If you don't buy more of them or, you know, you sit in cash for a little bit, things go up, you really beat yourself up. And so it's that opportunity cost, that FOMO, it does exist. And so that's why, you know, we try to keep a calm hand. We try to think through it. We try to analyze through different scenarios and ultimately say, okay, it does right now make sense to own a little bit of cash. And so for as much as we've bashed the T-bill and chill trade, say like, look, at some point, the Fed's not going to have your back, that interest rates will come down. I'm kind of a hypocrite right now because we do own a little bit, but I'm comparing that to taking risk. And so right now, I think that, I'm comfortable with that. We are comfortable with that. And I don't know. I just don't see there being this like blatant risk that no one's talking about.
Well, I love it. Jeff Sherman, Deputy CIO of Double Line Capital and also host of the Sherman Show podcast. It was great just having you on and getting to listen and learn from you. I really appreciate you being so generous with your time and all of your knowledge. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Okay. Thanks, Julia. Thanks for having me and look forward to seeing you again soon.
Of course.